My name is Joanne Belknap. I'm a professor in the Ethnic Studies Department at the University of Colorado, and I am a past president of the American Society of Criminology. The two things I want to talk about that makes me also relevant for this panel is I'm the first person in the faculty at CU to teach a class that's in a prison. I'm doing it for the third time this semester, and it's through the Inside Out program. And so half of this, I take 16 undergraduates, and we go to a prison. And this semester we're doing it in Golden at the men's prison there, the Colorado Correctional Facility, and we take a class together with 16 what we call inside students. And it's on social justice, and it's just been a really, really amazing experience. And I feel so strongly that education is such an important part of and I don't just feel like this. The research shows on keeping people as risk is as distance to getting tracked into the criminal legal system and also while in it to not recidivate. The other thing is for people living in Boulder County, I'm the vice president of our nonprofit Focus Reentry that we have community members that we do a little half a weekend training with to be mentors with people in the Boulder County Jail and coming out of the Boulder County Jail. And it's been incredible. Incredibly effective, and all of our mentors—we could never come up with the right word for it—but it's a really great program that has been successful and is exciting, and you meet lots of cool people. So, if any of you are interested in volunteering in any way with that, we have lots of different capacities to do that. So, that is who I am. We have an amazing panel here, and I just Kimberly Moore. It started this, as you can see, I'm not going to read their whole biographies. Oh, and I was supposed to say from the beginning, professor who can't follow directions. This is the Second Chance Life Beyond Prison, Programs and Policies for Productive Life After Incarceration. And this is Saturday, April 13th at 9 a.m. And it's all about me. We did that first. Okay, so Kimberly has done all this GoFund and different exciting things, but she also did some amazing mentoring with youth who are incarcerated. That's really, really exciting. And I'd like to tell something personal that isn't in there about everybody. And so she also provided a testimony, it sounds like, to then President Bill Clinton on using mobile and wireless and that sort. So please correct me if I do any of these.
I actually did a presentation on the South Lawn of the White House to President Bill Clinton, Al Gore. How many of you have T-Mobile? So I used to work for Verizon Wireless, and my job was to lobby him on releasing Spectrum so we could have T-Mobile and Sprint and all the other what's called PCS providers.
Great. Thank you. Tulio Cardoso is, and I had the great pleasure of being on a panel with him last year, and he came and talked to my 144 student class, race, class, gender, and crime, and they still talk about him. One of the outside students in my prison class this semester brings him up weekly in that class, and I also do too, but I think resilience is such an important part of this, and his program, The Last Mile, is truly amazing. The thing that he told me is that since he was here last year, he's married and had a baby boy named Tulio Christopher after himself and his father. So that was really wonderful. So, yay. And Dick Scruggs is the founder of the Second Chance program in Mississippi. He's been on 60 Minutes a couple of times talking, and he was a lawyer for the tobacco industry fighting that. The interesting thing about him that he told me that you wouldn't see in here is he is Trent Lott's brother-in-law.
You can hiss and boo if you want.
Okay, and Chris Tomford at the end here, he was he's a Lutheran minister who did stuff with in Attica prison right after the riots in 1978 to 86. He just went in and started asked to do a program, and it wasn't about the way he told the story to me was just beautiful this morning. I'm not a lawyer, and in this I'm not being a minister. This is about being your neighbor. How can I help? And he was all of the men in his program to had to have at least 22 felonies, so they were in for life. And so just really great. And his point was how to help them survive as a human in prison, which is a very difficult thing to do, sadly. And his thing that I found out is he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated magazine. How many people in here have been on the cover of Sports? Have you really?
Great.
Oh, my God. Small world.
Is that the swimsuit edition?
I was on the Coast Guard Cutter Eagle, and the eagle was featured on the...
Oh, my God. Wow. Very nice.
We have a special bond.
I have an open letter to Sports Illustrated about the swimsuit issue.
Yes.
But that's another story.
I do too.
And so he was the Princeton basketball team, and so that was great. So we have a really great panel here. I am going to kick it off by asking some questions, and then we'll have time for you all to ask questions as well. So my first question I'm going to ask is, and not everybody has to answer, so I'm going to just ask, what happens in prison that makes it more difficult for people when they get out that you think people need to know about? Or in incarceration, juvenile institutions, too.
Oh.
Okay.
Fools rush in where wise people fear to tread. From my experience of Attica, which is a data point of one, Attica was a violent place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think living every single day for 20, 30 years in an environment of violence and unpredictable violence, you didn't know exactly when it might hit you, made it very difficult for the men I talked with. Very few got out, but when they did get out, they were just surprised that people were not trying to stab them or beat them up or push them down or do something violent to them. So the conditioning of living in a violent atmosphere is difficult when you just want to walk down the street, get on the bus, and work at Kodak or something.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to chime in on that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I completely agree with the whole aspect that being around unpredictable violence definitely creates a lot of things. Myself, I realized yesterday in another panel, I was around 13 acts of what I would consider ultra-violence.
Yes.
And it really shaped how I resonate with the news now.
Yes.
So the other thing, though, I think generally across the board that happens is you get a lot of people that have been victims of violence or have been involved in violence to protect themselves, and what ends up happening is you get removed from society, even society on the inside. So
yes,
there's a lot of stories of people getting incarcerated, and then once they're incarcerated, they're sent to administrative segregation, which is
right,
like incarceration within incarceration.
Yep.
And then when they're released, they're not only unable to process that people aren't trying to kill them or stab them or something, but they don't have the social empathy and the social skills to be able to sit with us and discuss these kinds of things.
Yep.
Or be able to hold down a job, because there's a lot of different things they still haven't processed. I think that's one of them. The other thing I think is really true is that across the board, there are a very small number of programs. Like, we're doing better today than we used to be.
Yeah.
But across the board, there's a very small number of programs that really enable people to have the social, the interpersonal development that they need. And more importantly, frankly, life skills, and both actual skills-based and soft skills, to be able to cope in a society. And like, frankly, technology is moving so fast. You know, you go to some cities, you have to pay for your taxi with a smart screen. If you've been incarcerated and you're not even familiar with that, that's a factor that might prevent you from even getting on a taxi that got you to your job interview in the first place. And that's a big problem.
Yeah.
It's a technological divide that is there. So
mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that jumped out at me at first.
Hmm. Thank you.
We ran a program at a juvenile detention center in Alexandria, Virginia. And what I noticed was that, you know, kids felt like they didn't have a voice.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've got all this authority over them, and, you know, they're assigned maybe a public defender or an attorney, and then their parents are, you know, and they feel like, well who's going to listen to me? Like, can I say what's happening for me? Can I, you know, contribute to, you know, what I think is going to be helpful for me? So what I saw was they felt like they didn't have their own voice. And one of the programs, actually two different programs we did to help facilitate that, especially for their courtroom experience, was What's Up, Judge? Mm-hmm. And basically teaching them how the court works, the juvenile court works in Virginia, and their ability to advocate for themselves. Like, until 2010, a young person was not required to have a lawyer representing them. 2010. So they literally, their parents aren't allowed to be with them at that table. They're literally there by themselves. They don't know what they're doing. Yeah. Their public defender, you know, met with them 30 minutes before their court. They have no idea what the, you know, the veracity of their charges are. And they're just stooped, you know. But here I'm supposed to be in this court, and I have to just respond and deal with whatever someone hands me. So we felt like that was a really powerful thing for us to do to help them find their voice in court.
Thank you.
If I can weigh in, Joanne, on what happens in prison that makes it harder to reenter. I think that was the basic question. I spent 6 years in federal prison, two different ones. Didn't have any violent fellow inmates. There were a few fights, usually over the television. But even the low security prison I was in for the first year had older men there that perhaps had been violent in the past, but were kind of past the age of that.
Right.
And then the rest of the time I was in a camp, and there's virtually no violence in what's called a camp, minimum security. And any even harsh language with another inmate will get you kicked out and moved up to a higher security place. So I never encountered any sort of violence other than just two guys getting into a fist fight, and that was infrequent. But the thing that one of the things that the federal prison system did well was that any inmate who did not have a high school diploma had to get a GED or sit in class until he got it. Mm-hmm. And still many of them didn't. They just drew pictures in class and didn't pay any attention. But I'm running a foundation now. When I came home from prison 6 years ago, I started a foundation called Second Chance Mississippi, which is really not aimed at ex-offenders. It's really high school dropouts and people who have no work skill. And we work now with the community college system in Mississippi, which has really embraced the mission of work skills training and adult basic education, that is getting them a high school equivalency diploma. When I was in prison, because I had a law degree, I was asked to tutor and then instruct full-time. That was my prison job, was instructing other inmates. And it gave me a new sense of purpose. That was, other than separation from my family and friends, loss of any sense of purpose when I went to prison was the worst thing for me. And those of you who teach or have taught, and you know the rewarding feeling it gives you when you see the light bulb go on in a student. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting with grown men, many of whom want to reconnect with their families after having ruptured all their relationships, and they want to reconnect by simple things like being able to do homework with a granddaughter or a daughter. And so when you see the light bulb go on, I taught math, by the way, for the math section of the GED, which was really not easy, and it was my worst subject in school. That's why I went to law school, so I could avoid any sort of math courses. But in a land of the blind, the one-eyed man can be king. You know? So in any event, now I've been drafted to work with in my state, Mississippi, on reentry, because the state system doesn't provide any mandatory education of any kind. Mm. And as a result of that, there are about 5,000 inmates, male and female, being released from prison every year, who 80% of whom will be rearrested within 5 years.
Right.
The recidivism rate is unacceptably high. And I contend that it's because they're not given any educational options, or any skill training options, particularly life skill training. The importance of punctuality, for example, just simple things that most of us take for granted. So if your mindset is that prison is just to punish, right, you're going to get a guy out the other end who's going to come out with the same skills he went in with and some worse ones. If you think about prison as rehabilitation, a lot more work needs to be done there, because what the biggest impediment that I can see in prison is that it's simply warehousing in most cases,
right,
and no intellectual stimulation, and they're destined to come back in a revolving door within 5 years. Four out of five of them will.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'd like to respond to that too. Thank you for what you're doing, first of all.
Yeah. Can you talk into the microphone a little more?
I appreciate that. People not being heard in prison, a lack of education, a lack of life skills is what creates this end result. I work for an organization called The Last Mile. I should have said this earlier too. We're focusing heavily on just those things as well. And I think the interesting thing is, I just want to briefly say, when we've taught people education, so computer coding in this case, we've given them life skills, social skills. We've worked with them to provide them mentorships, both within their prison, remotely with other people in other prisons, obviously supervised. We've talked remotely with people in certain cities that are providing and broadcasting this to other faraway facilities. And when we create this opportunity of lots of interaction, lots of life skills, lots of, frankly, just opportunities, we've been able to have a result of 0% recidivism of everybody that we've worked with.
Wow.
We've been very fortunate to be able to have our program work in 3 states, 12 classrooms across those 3 states. We've educated probably close to 600 people. Don't hold me to the numbers. And I would guess, again, don't hold me to numbers, but probably around 15 to 20% of those people have been released. Not everybody gets out right away. And that's a number that's held true for all of those people. So as we have these conversations, I think it's really important to think about why isn't there existing legislation? Why isn't there existing mechanisms? And why did private industry, why did nonprofits have to step in and do this when clearly we as society are all the winners here? And these programs and these legislators should be working on this for us too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This is great. One of the things, I just resonate so much with things people are saying, and one of the things that GEDs are just a huge thing for incarcerated adults and youth. That's where a lot of them get this. And one of the studies I did at the Denver County Jail of 204 women, when I would ask them, what are the 3 most important things in your life? I can't tell you how many of them, good or bad, how many of them said getting my GED. That was such a huge thing for them. But the United States has also made it a whole lot harder and more expensive to get GEDs. So the Boulder County Jail, who used to do them a lot, since they changed the policies, it's a lot harder. And I just thought of something for one of my Inside Out class this semester. One of the outsides, at the end we go around, we sit in a circle, inside, outside, inside, outside students, and one of the outside students, the young woman, undergraduate here, said, I'm shocked. And so we said, why? And she said, I just found out, and her classmate, who's been in prison, she said, he just told me he was told to take this class because he's antisocial. And we were all like, he's the most outgoing, warm, friendly person. But again, talking about how prisons, I just really appreciate what you all said about that dehumanization, and that's the main thing that the Inside Riverside students are worried about it, that they're going to be judged. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the role of education is crucial, and it turned around on me in a different kind of way. St. Bonaventure University, which is a Franciscan university not far from Attica Prison, started a humanities program in the prison. Mm-hmm. And one of the books they read was Dante's Inferno, and I don't know how many people have read Dante's Inferno anymore, but it's a list of 33 sins or crimes that people commit. Mm-hmm. And the appropriate punishment according to Dante for those. It wasn't funny, but it was. When we were reading Dante's Inferno with this group, yeah, I've done that. And, you know, murder, yeah, I did that. You know, whatever the 33 was, there was somebody in our group. And to your point, it sort of gave them a voice, a way of, through literature, to say what had happened to them, and then to process this. So education, I think, not only just to prepare people when they get out to have a job and be able to stand on their own, but also to give voice or find some words to explain what they had been involved in and how people might perceive them. So it was quite powerful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. The next question I want to ask the panel is, how do you think that gender, race, class, age, disability, or other characteristics like that potentially marginalize people, is that related to incarceration and getting out and reentry?
I know for young people, black and brown students are criminalized in school, and so their behavior, which comes from all kinds of things, gets criminalized, right? In Virginia, again, truancy is basically a crime. After you've missed school a certain amount of times, you then get pulled into the juvenile justice system, and you get detained after you have not gone to school a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
So acting out by not going to school for all kinds of reasons, stress, you know, whatever the case might be. Now you're in a juvenile maximum security juvenile detention center because you missed school. And now you're with students who actually have committed crimes, and they look really cool.
Yeah.
Right? They look really cool, and they you know, have a little swag, and those kids want that, right? They start feeling this connection and this belonging, and then because they're timed there anywhere from 30 days to 6 months, they're going to get out. And guess what? They're going to connect with those young people,
right,
and start doing what they do, as a sense of belonging. And so happens disproportionately more for black and brown students. And so for them, it's really, really difficult. Also for young girls, most of those facilities don't really have the right kind of support systems,
right,
for girls in juvenile detention. And so it's difficult because the majority of the staff are men, and they just have a difficult time trying to provide the right kind of programming that can help girls who are in that facility, because most of them are over-sexualized and don't really know how to find their scene outside of sex. And so it's a great opportunity, captive audience, to start building that self-esteem. So I think that as they begin to understand what they can contribute in the world and this, the presence of who they are as girls, that they will start making a different choice. So I do think that they are really, when they're brought into the juvenile justice system, it really increases their over-sexualization of their themselves, because they start making these connections with the boys. It's amazing how they are communicating in that facility. And it's really hard to break. You know, kids are really slick. Y'all know that, right? Super slick.
Age is something that I was surprised to find out. Not too many people in the group of men with whom I met were released, but some had been there for a long time, 25, 30 years, mm-hmm. And I was a callow young lad then, and probably 30 years old, and some of these men are like my age now, in their 70s, and they had completely adapted themselves to prison culture and had some status, some of them, mm-hmm. there, and responsibilities. And then to go out, to be released, one man was released on clemency by the governor, then governor of the state, and fortunately, there was another group of people to welcome him in, but his family had sort of given up on him over those years. He had no friends. He had, to your point, Tulio, he had no notion of how the outside world worked, and he was just adrift there by virtue of his age, so it was very difficult for him, but he did manage.
You know, if I can weigh in on that, Chris, to that point, people who have been in prison a long time don't fear coming back. That's where they make their relationships. They're comfortable there. They get institutionalized.
Right.
And so when they go out, they try to go straight for a while.
Yeah.
But if they don't have a skill, and they go back to their old circle of friends and people that have taken their place, they are more ready to commit a crime, because they're not afraid of going back. They've gained a certain amount of status and social position within the prison system if they've been there a while, and that's one of the real problems with recidivism. I'll tell you an interesting story from personal experience. Right before I was sent to prison, I knew I was going to be. I asked my lawyer if I had to tell the other inmates why I was there. I was ashamed and embarrassed, and I didn't want to have to talk about it. And he says, "Oh, no, it's none of their business. You don't have to tell them. The prison staff will know why you're there, but you don't have to tell them." I said, "Okay, good." So I went to a low-security prison, which was a surprise to me. It was a change right at the very last weekend before I reported, and I was allowed to self-report. So I had not spent a single hour in jail before that. And so I show up. I get checked in and processed in, and I'm given a roommate, a young guy who's serving a really long sentence. He was only about 28, but it was a nonviolent drug offense, young white guy. He was very cold to me. He asked me initially why I was there. And I said, "Well, I made a mistake, and I'd rather not talk about it." He said, "Well, what kind of mistake?" Well, that was the wrong answer. What I didn't know was that about 25% of the men sent to that prison were pedophiles. Mm-hmm. And they are really ostracized by the other inmates. Mm-hmm. I never saw any of them brutalized, but they're very much ostracized and shunned. And so my reluctance to talk about why I was there, for whatever reason, an older white guy coming into prison for the first time fits the profile of men who are sent to prison for pedophilia. And I had no idea. And for the first week, I was shunned. I couldn't get anybody to... If I sat down at a table in the chow hall, guys would give me a hard look and get up and move to another table. I figured, okay, this is really going to be tough. Mm-hmm. Really going to be tough. And my roommate was trying to get moved to a different room. It wasn't exactly a cell, but it certainly wasn't a suite either. But more like a dorm room. He was trying to get moved. And then, so after almost a week, I walked back in the room, and he had this big smile on his face. And he says, "Scruggs," he says, "Bob Stone says you're okay." I said, "Well, great. Who's Bob Stone?"
Yeah.
Well, it turned out Bob Stone was a man who had been in prison for 30 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he had gotten a PhD on his own in prison. And I think next to the warden, this guy was the most influential guy in that prison. Right. They call those guys a shot caller in a lot of prisons. He's the inmate that everybody respects for one reason or the other. But this guy was about my age, and so he had read about my case in the Wall Street Journal, so he knew, you know. I mean, so Rich was rare that anybody there read the Wall Street Journal, but he had, and so I was eternally thankful to the guy. And I think he's since been released, but he had killed a DEA agent when he was a really young man, and so he had gotten a 30 to life kind of sentence. But anyway, my roommate had this big grin, and he says, "Scruggs, you don't know how happy I am that you're a legitimate criminal." That's a quote. And I said, "Well, boy, I'm glad I'm a legitimate criminal, too."
So I'm telling you, sometimes there's good times behind bars.
Yeah.
But it's good when people don't go there.
Yeah.
So just one of the things I want to just chime in on, too, because, you know, I'm Latino, minority, went to prison, but I was really close to, geographically close to, like, a place where there's lots of people like me, there's lots of people in tech, there's lots of people who want to help, there's lots of people who literally only have a 15 to 30 minute drive across the bridge to go if they want to volunteer to prison, and, like, geo-proximity really helped in my case, right? And I didn't have as good of an opportunity of getting, like, support from shot callers where I was in the prison. Like, they didn't give a crap about me, unfortunately. I had a few problems. I had to go to one or two. But one of the things that I know in the work that we're doing professionally at The Last Mile is that what happens in places like San Quentin is so unique and so much of an outlier that it's not really representative of the rest of the nation. Mm-hmm. And you get this huge disparity because most of these places are, by design, built in locations that are far away.
Right.
They do that because it's cheap land, and they do that because it's also harder on families. It's an unfortunate truth, in my opinion. Let you be the judge of that. But one of the things that we have noticed is that regardless of your gender, regardless of your age, you can, with support, come back and be successfully gainfully employed. We have people that are, you know, in their 50s that have gone to go work for Mark Zuckerberg's wife. You know, was not a developer before, taught himself how to do that, and he's upper level management, which is pretty awesome. I should ask him for a job. On the other side of the coin, we have juveniles that fall into many different categories as far as age, gender, where they are in the United States. You know, we work in Indiana, we work in Kansas. Those are states where you don't necessarily associate as being the same as California and the way California thinks about some of these issues. But they're also having success there. And I think that one of the things that makes a really big difference for people to be able to successfully get out is again, removing the barriers to the community. Mm-hmm. That is such a critical component because really it's up to you as a community to let us know, like, what is the work environment like? What is the expectation that you have of us when we return so that we can actually start working on day one of our incarceration to meet those expectations? So we've had time to practice on the inside before we get out and have to do it for reals on the outside. And I think that there's another notion I want to just really clarify is the inside is still real life. I was corrected by a guy who was doing like 30, 45 years by that point, and where he had been in there for quite some time, like one of the OGs of the prison. He told me, "Hey, man, I slipped." I said, "You know, back in the real world." And he said, "No, this is the real world.
This is the real world.
Yeah, it's just a different part. You're not used to." And the thing I'm trying to say is, with our organization specifically, what I'm really trying to dance around and hint at, without just trying to soapbox our organization, is the ability to bring in those resources, even if it's telebroadcasted into a classroom that's in the middle of nowhere, has huge impacts on the population when they get out. Mm-hmm. I say this because, again, back to the reality of outliers. Like, San Quentin is an outlier, but it's awesome that it happens to be right next to a city where there's lots of people that are in the tech industry, and that's what we're teaching, and that they want to show that. So we're able to set up an office in downtown, and then we can broadcast into San Quentin, or we can broadcast into Indiana, should we need to. And I think it's really important because that's one of the ways that we can remove these barriers because, yes, as a Latino, when I went through the prison system, nobody quite really honestly cared much about me.
Right.
It's not that I needed somebody to care about me, but I wasn't enough of a certain ethnic group. I wasn't enough of a gangbanger. I wasn't enough of a screw up where my type of crime, like gay people, pity on me and they wanted to offer support. I was just kind of one of those in between people, and I didn't have those resources. I was very fortunate just to suck it up, realize that I was probably going to get deported, and like hit the books because nobody would care about me in another country. And I certainly don't want to be I like having nice clothes and those kind of things, right? So, point being is that's an outlier case too. So I think broadcasting, for example, into places is a really interesting thing to think about. It's like one of the solutions. I don't think it's the only solution, but I really do think as a social component, like we as society need to get in there and we need to resonate with each other. So people that have experience, if you're older, if you're a certain ethnicity, if you're a certain gender, I would love to see you volunteer some time, if possible, in your schedules to mentor people of those types of backgrounds so they know what to expect from you when they return home. So,
thank you so much. I'm getting great questions here, and I am taking the electronic, whatever this is. On 61, I don't know. This isn't tweeting, right? I don't know. I'm trying to. These really great questions, and some of them are kind of being answered. But a kind of theme in this, and you kind of, especially, well, everybody's talked about it. But how do you change the mindset of somebody who's in, and whether it's through? And I'm just kind of trying to combine because I have so many questions here. Whether it's through programming, entrepreneurship. Just different things, and then specifically, many people, Tulio, are curious how people got into your program. But what are the different programs, including like life skills and entrepreneurial and all sorts of things that, and education that can, are going to help people to change their mindsets?
At the Urban Passage, and that name was intentional. I chose that intentionally because it reminded me of the Middle Passage of slavery. And being at the juvenile detention is like a middle passage for kids. And so where they could live or die, essentially. And I felt like it was our responsibility to help kids make one new decision by the time they got ready to leave, because the fault of adults who are so want so much for these young people is to just lay so many things in front of them that they can do. Go to school, go to work, get your GED. It's too much for them, right? They've not really done one thing successfully yet, but I'm giving all these, and they're great. But our job was to help them make one new decision when they got out. And through one of our programs, we would do that. Part of the reason why I'm on this panel is because of the life of a young lady that I met when I was there. She had 7 felony arrests, Latina young lady. The last 3 were with 3 Arlington County police officers who were trying to take her to a group home, and she didn't want to go. And so she got arrested by them. And while she was in juvenile detention, she was in this program that she had to stay in for 6 months. And if she successfully completed, she'd be released to the community. If not, she was going to juvenile prison. 7 years. Okay. And so at the age of 16, she had to make a decision. What, you know, I've got to figure this out. Now, she wasn't a good student at all, but what she did see, to your point, was education was going to be the way that she was going to be able to survive. So she made a decision, I'm going to focus on my education. So the first thing she did was have school inside of juvenile detention, right. A legitimate public school inside juvenile detention. So she started paying attention in class, and so by the time she got released, she was at least a little interested. She didn't have confidence necessarily, but she got interested in education. The second major decision that she made, not talking to me, was she got emancipated from her mother. She was Latino, illegal immigrant. Her mother was illegal immigrant. And she realized that the only way for me to succeed in life was to become a ward of the state. and be able to take advantage of the programs that are available to me. And by making that choice, she it literally changed her whole life, and honestly, the trajectory of her family as well. So she graduated from high school by the hair of her chinny chin chin. When we were riding to graduation, I said, "Now you know this is a miracle, right? And you need to thank every teacher for helping you cross the finish line." And so from there, she was good at hair, and she decided to do that. And she got exposed to cosmetology, and that was sort of her first place of success. But her real success was making the one decision of, I've got to focus on school.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think our program was based on the simple notion, could we help the men in prison have a normal conversation so that if they ever did get out, they would know how to have a real conversation with people. So when we would meet every Friday for about 3 hours and have a conversation about whatever came up about their life. And then this program I was part of was funded by a synagogue, a Roman Catholic church, and three Protestant churches. So we bought a bakery in Rochester, New York. And when a few men would get out, they had a job to work in the bakery, and it was part of the deal. If you're going to get out and we're responsible, you have to work in this bakery for 100 days and live in community upstairs in the bakery, because they were used to living with other men in a kind of community. And then we would visit them both in prison, and then when they came out, stay with them in this bakery. And one of the people, Western New York is a very rural area, it's not part of New York City at all. And so many of the people in our churches were dairy farmers, so on Sundays we would all go to one of these dairy farms and have like a picnic with children and husbands and wives and so forth. So try to establish some sense of normal conversation in prison, and then when we get out, continue what would a normal conversational life look like, at least for 100 days, and it seemed to work pretty well.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah. Tullio, did you want to respond?
Well, actually, I was going to apologize and ask you if you can repeat part of the question. When I heard it, I was so excited, and then Kimberly said something that jumped out at me, and I was so excited, I started writing something down, and then I realized...
About the... as part of the programming and reframing mindsets of people in prison, part of it was technology, entrepreneurship, and other things, but how do people get into your program?
Okay. Sorry. Do you want to go first? Should I answer?
No, I'll just... my program, Second Chance Mississippi, is not aimed at returning offenders. It's named, as I mentioned, I think, aimed at high school dropouts or people with absolutely no work skills. Only recently have we been asked to get involved in perhaps marrying up existing programs that the community colleges we work with provide in work skills and adult basic education, and marry that up with incarcerated people in the state. And there's some real good science out there, some real good data, one particularly by the RAND Corporation, that shows a 40% decrease in recidivism for inmates who get a GED and or a skill training program and complete it successfully while they're in prison. They're 40% less likely to come back. So there's a lot of bang for the buck, and yet, at least in my state, and I think in the Deep South it's generally true, there's not any effective training program for inmates. Nothing mandatory, nothing that encourages them. There's a nascent program now in drug courts to divert particularly first offenders, nonviolent first offenders who have drug crimes, to divert them over into educational programs, mm-hmm. which they can get an expungement of their mm-hmm. of their charges and a dismissal of their charges if they successfully complete, which I really encourage and hope that continues. But Julio is the one that actually does this from on the inside, and Chris has had that experience too at Attica. So I'm going to defer to you.
Thank you, but yeah, I think we're all part of the solution from so many different angles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to dovetail on what you were saying, though, about how education and even have just like a GED can reduce by 40%, that's amazing. I'm reminded of a statistic, and again, I'm gonna ask for forgiveness and say, don't hold me to the numbers, but I'm pretty sure they're accurate. I have a friend of mine, Chuck Patillo. Chuck runs, or used to up until very, very recently, the Prison Industry Authority for the state of California. So that means that if you are in a prison, or excuse me, if you were on a college campus in California, the seats you were sitting on would have been made by people that were incarcerated.
Same with here.
Okay. And so he ran that department over there, and one of the numbers that, if I recall correctly, in a conversation that he was telling me is because he was quite proud of his recidivism rate. Even vocational skills can have a huge impact. And I think he was seeing about a 6 to 7% recidivism rate among the people that were in there. So I want to really give credit where credit is due and say it's not only technology that has to be a solution in order for it to work. It's not only going to be certain kinds of programs, or it doesn't have to be limited to GED. It could be a lot of things. And but yeah, I totally agree that education across the board, skills, is just super important, because we can work on ourselves inside as much as we want, but unless we know how to do something and frankly, you know, bring value to somebody else so that we can make a living, we're going to get back there sooner or later. So, you know, to dovetail on what I was saying that excited me about what Kimberly had, and I think it's a really good segue into how people get into our program, making decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Such a crucial thing. Mm-hmm. See, the thing about people in general, I can summarize it in what a lifer once told me when I was walking around a track, stressing out about having like years ahead of me to serve. And I think he said something like, you know, yeah, make some decisions. And I said, you know, we started going on that. What does decisions mean? And he said, well, you know, kids take choices.
Mm-hmm.
You can do this, you can do that. Mm-hmm. This is my option, that's my option. And adults make decisions. And I think the distinct difference is that a decision doesn't necessarily present itself as doable. Like, you might have to figure out how to make that path for yourself. And that's really important, because if you're a juvenile and you don't necessarily know, there isn't a decision where you can just say, well, I can just do this and I'll be all solved. No, like, there's such an amount of things you have to solve to make that happen. And it can be a journey where you just have to have a guiding compass and a guiding moral, and you're going to follow it, and you'll see how you get there. Looking back, it'll make sense. But going forward, you know, you just got to take step by step. So dovetailing or segueing into how people get into the last mile, I think what we do that is really neat about decisions and choices is we do create a choice in the facilities that we operate in. And the choice is to get involved with what you see other people there doing. Those other people are the ones that are in our class. I think our class students are our biggest ambassadors within the facilities that we operate in, because while we on the outside can come and bring computers and can bring, you know, mentors and all these things, like, how does it resonate with the people on the inside? And I think what's neat is our students typically have study groups on any given Sunday in the yard, where they're teaching not only themselves but other people that are in the yard that want to get in on this, that really see that, hey, that person was just serving time. He's been locked up since he was 15. He just did 20 years. He just got out. He's just working at a tech company. And he's just back doing a presentation on stage. Like, holy crap, I can resonate with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it inspires people on the inside. So we provide a choice, and choices get involved. But that doesn't mean that it's going to automatically create a decision. So over time, people that get into our programs, we go through a very selective process. There's about 10 applicants to every one seat in the facilities that we're at. They don't need to have necessarily a GED. We want them to be in the process of getting that. We want them to be in the process of also continuing higher education if they do have a GED. But in addition to that, we test them, like general logic. Like, can they reason? Can they figure out some math problems? Can they... they don't have to have a computer background whatsoever, but we just want to make sure that they can at least keep up on day
function.
One.
Yeah.
And then when the people are in there, we really take them very quickly straight into what we do. So first semester, think of it like we do like 6 month blocks. So the first cohort there will go through like HTML and CSS and some entry level JavaScript. But keep in mind, most of the people that are in our program have never touched a computer in their life. So I think it's pretty amazing that it's not a limiting factor. They go through that, they go to the next 6 months, and those people then now learn some more advanced level stuff. They learn things that are what companies like Facebook use to build their apps, React Native, some more advanced level concepts. We have people that then graduate and go to another more advanced class, and they build tools to help support the education across our other facilities. And I think what's really interesting about how that works is because then those same people go back home and tell their other people, like, hey, I just built a search engine for use by other people here in prison, and they're using it in other prisons, and suddenly, like, a person sees value in themselves. You know, I can tell you, not everybody sees that when you first go to prison. You think,
right.
That's it, man, I screwed up. I don't want to talk about anything.
Right.
Like, I just want to do my time. Like, and suddenly, the conversation shifts to, this is awesome. I'm so happy I'm here. And not only that, we then provide opportunities to meet mentors, opportunities to meet community members, opportunities to see what they need to get out and be successful and connect them with the right people. I think moving forward, our program is going to continue to grow, to continue to transition what it's like for people after they get out, because there's a lot of things that they need, whether it's technology, access to more ongoing education, access to all the big questions outside of employment, and we're working on them while they're still inside to answer those questions. But, you know, without saying too much, I really think the distinct difference in decisions and in choices is we roll into a facility and provide a choice, knowing that not everybody's ready to make a decision. But what we're asking people is just to try it for another day and see if you like it. And then the next day, try it for another day.
Mm-hmm.
And letting you as a student organically make a decision if this is for you. And if it is, we're here for you the whole way.
Thank you. We have about 20 minutes left, and I'm trying to, like, getting great questions here. The main theme of questions we haven't talked about is private versus public prisons, and also, which I think also deals with a lot of some of the other questions about what is the government doing or not doing. So that's one. Another one is just the prisons as the major housing thing from the mentally ill in the United States now since the Reagan years. And then some of this we talked about, but felons getting jobs afterwards, especially if you're a sexual offender. So I'm trying to group all of these together, and these are but the private versus privatized versus public prisons is kind of the biggest theme that we haven't addressed yet. If anybody would like to jump into this.
I know I just spoke, but I'd really love to just say
please
thing on
do.
It. Lived in public prison, lived in private prison. Public prison was, marginal programs. Private prisons had no programs unless you happened to be from Alaska,
right.
And then you got everything under the sun because they could cash in on you. Long story. We've looked at what would it be like to partnership with a private company or a private prison? And I think a lot of the moral questions here is just like, if they're making, and I think this is your question, it's not our question, so I just want to make a distinction. Or there are questions as society. Why would a private prison want programs that help people stay out when at the end of the day, their stockholders are making money? Those beds are warm. That means that they're making money. I'm not sure, to be honest, like why what their true motives are, but I will say that there's been interest among private prisons to provide better services, better reentry tools, and to really start to step in where they've seen the nonprofit space step in and provide opportunities. I cannot stand up here and say, as a person that represents my company, that we should or shouldn't do that. But I can stand up here and say, as a person who spent 3.5 years in a private facility in Eloy, California, where there's nothing to do but get sand in your mouth on your way to your chow hall, or get sprayed by crop dusters that don't bother to turn off the crop dusting spray while they do a U-turn over your facility because they don't get it, I would be upset if I didn't have an opportunity for an educational experience while I was there because a room full of people thought that it was morally conflicting. As an inmate in a private prison, I still want something.
Yep.
I don't care what the optics look like. And I want to acknowledge that because the optics is a tough question. So.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've spent time in both as well. Not very much time in private prisons, but typically when I was moving or being moved by the Federal Bureau of Prisons from one facility to another, I would be dumped off for a week or 10 days at a private prison. I looked into their business model when I was in prison. I had plenty of time on my hands. Mm-hmm. Their business model is based on a per diem charge to the federal government or the state government, as the case may be. And it can be as high as $60, $70 a day. And this is I'm going back now 8 or 10 years. They get a guaranteed number as well. They get a guaranteed number of beds that they negotiate with the government. It's usually 80% requirement to keep 80%. They can bill their per diem if they only have 50% of their beds full, they still get their 80% minimum. Their margins, their profit, is based on the delta difference between the per diem and what they actually spend on an inmate. And invariably, I found that the prison staff was barely trained, if at all, and I was in three different ones at three different times for short periods, but the staffs were playing grab ass with the inmates, if you can pardon that expression. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Bureau of Prison staff in established prisons was much more professional. The private prisons had nothing to read. You'd line a cell and just look at the ceiling. It was closed in incarceration. Shoved the food under the door three times a day. Two showers a week. Luckily, I wasn't there very long, but that was the routine. And interestingly, to give you the measure of how these guys operate, their contract, this was a company called GEO Group. I think it's the second largest private prison group in the country to Corrections Corp of America, but I don't think there's a nickel's worth of difference between them. They had a separate charge that they could make to the government for medication. Mm-hmm. But did not, so it was over and above their per diem. Well, when I went in this place, I was there for 10 days, right outside of Atlanta, called Lovejoy. It was an old state prison that they had turned over, or somehow this organization had acquired. And so I was there for 10 days, and they ordered 90 days worth of prescription medicine for me.
Oh, yeah.
And I brought, when I got there, I had a supply of blood pressure medication, is what it was. And it wasn't expensive meds, but it was, I brought my own and I left with my own. And they somehow got reimbursed for 90 days worth of medication from the federal government that they didn't have to use or spend. So it's a business practice, I think, that is inherently corrupt and inherently fosters recidivism, because their whole goal is to get you back. Yeah. And they lobby hard against any, they're incredible, particularly in California. I've read, Tulio, you can speak to it better than I can. The prison guards union out there is one of the most powerful in the world. I mean, these guys fight like hell to keep sentences longer and criminalize more conduct, but that's also true in the private prison industry. Incarceration is their business, and business has been good.
Yeah.
Ugh. It also doesn't just happen in adult prisons. In the juvenile detention center that I was in, we had our programs in. At some point, they took the unit where the six-month program that Norma was in, they made that a place for kids who were here illegally. And that became is the best unit in the entire building.
Right.
And they made that the unit, and it held like 16 kids. And it was amazing. And they were willing to. So what happened was, what the result was, is that for those kids who would have come to the juvenile detention center, what they would do is they would bring the kids who would come to the juvenile detention there. And for the kids who were in the juvenile detention who were likely to go to juvenile prison, they just moved them to juvenile prison faster.
One thing I'd like to add to the remarks about private versus public prison. There are many county jails around the country that are profit centers,
right,
for their county governments because they store federal inmates, they warehouse federal inmates. So it's not, it's more pernicious than just private prisons. County governments are in on the deal too, because I know my county jail in my hometown, the sheriff, I've known the sheriff for all my life, and he told me, he said, this is one of the biggest profit centers in the county, this jail, because they house federal inmates, and they make the difference between a per diem and what they actually spend on the inmate. So they spend as little as they can on the inmate. And So it's a very pernicious system, and it's not just private prisons that are doing it.
Yeah, thank you. Does anybody want to talk? Let's see, I'm trying to think. What were the other questions that I... about the seriously mentally ill in the prison. And as one person pointed out, and I found in my research too, that PTSD can be so advanced it can be a serious mental illness, but just kind of the treatment, the warehousing of mentally ill in prisons, does anybody want to talk about that?
I can say that they start treating young people with psychotropic medication in juvenile detention. In Virginia, you're required to be evaluated within 72 hours. And so they may put kids on depression medication, any manner of psychotropic medication that they've never really even been on before. Once they get exposed there. So then it's in their system the entire time that they're there, and they're left there with a prescription for them to continue when they get released.
I worked in Attica from in the late 70s and early 80s, so PTSD was not an issue, or it was an issue, but not
wasn't labeled.
Known.
Yeah.
But I would guess there were 15, 20 people in my group, and I would guess half of them were Vietnam veterans who had committed unusually violent crimes, and I'm guessing in retrospect it was PTSD. There was no therapy that I was aware of them, and there was often very severe, it's called solitary confinement, which was a 10 by 10 stainless steel cube, and you were in there with no clothing for a period of time if you had committed more violence within the prison. So no therapy or medication that I was aware of, and no diagnosis or sympathy for what these men were bringing back from Vietnam.
Yeah.
I'd love to add to, less from the professional hat, more from the something happened hat.
Yeah.
I totally agree with Kimberly. Like, now we've made a big growth from no opportunities for any kind of psychotropics, the word she said, medications, to where we are today. But I think that something that's a sad truth to acknowledge and question about our healthcare professionals that are serving in our states is how much exactly are we giving them? Because something that I think is very honest and sad is the majority of issues in populations are controlled by medication. I cannot say people do it on purpose, but I can't say you see quite a number of people that spend 23 hours a day asleep
yes.
on their bed.
Right, knocked
and,
out.
And coincidentally, they happen to be the same ones that are on psych meds. And I can't say that with friends that take psych meds, the ones on the outside here, you know, I have family on them too, they're not asleep 23 hours a day. So I'm wondering why.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of times people say to me, they have TVs in prison as if that's a terrible thing. And most of them have to pay for their televisions. But it's like, I said, it's like parents who don't want to play with their own kids. They sit them in front of a television. It keeps them out. And same with psychotropic drugs. And I did a study on girls that were convicted as adults. And a bunch of them said, we're in here for drugs, and yet they're drugging us up on these psychotropic drugs.
Yeah.
And was not lost on these girls. And I just, that's such an important point. Thank you. Let's see. Are there any closing things that any of you would like to say?
I want to close on a high note. Norma, who I've been referencing, went on to get her cosmetology license and realized, I don't think I want to do this my whole life, and made a decision to go to community college. And decided, she was going to do it. And again, I'm thinking about her high school experience, and I'm going, okay. So walking her through the process of going into college, because she's around no one who's been into college before, so she has no idea of the inundation of paperwork that you've got to do to get there. So she completed her associate's degree.
Great.
And went on to graduate from Old Dominion University
Wow.
with a degree in biology. Mm-hmm. And today she's a third year pharmacy student.
Oh my God.
She's also the first person in her family to buy a car.
Great.
Wow.
And she inspired her sister to go to college as well. And she graduated from George Mason University last December and is headed to law school in the fall.
My God.
Great.
Oh, that is great.
Mine is sort of a humorous story about me. After I'd been there for 3 or 4 years, the guards were highly suspicious. They didn't want people coming in from the outside. So we were almost strip search. We had to take off all of our clothing except for our underwear whenever we came in, and they looked through everything to kind of intimidate us, I think. So after a couple of years, they said, "Mr. Reverend Tom Ford, you look pretty reliable. Go to the reception building, a room about this big, where people were either brought in or out of prison. So, and they will give you a pass there so we don't have to search you anymore. You seem reliable." So I went in, took off all my clothes, and had the standard shot head on sideways, and was fingerprinted. And so another man who was wandering around semi-naked in this room came over and said, "Are you getting out today?" It didn't register with me what he meant. And I said, "Yeah, about 3 o'clock. He said, "Well, to your points, make good decisions when you get out." And I said, "Okay." So you may be a graduate of Princeton and on the cover of Sports Illustrated, but when you have no clothes on, there's no difference between you and a multiple felony offender. So it was
I'll tell you another humorous story, if I can. In addition to being a legitimate criminal, one of my close friends, and I'm name dropping, is John Grisham.
Oh yeah,
the novelist. All right, John's an opera laureate together, and known each other a long time. And he came to see me in prison. And you can imagine the buzz around the prison staff when the likes of John Grisham shows up to see an inmate. And he didn't come on the weekends when they have normal visitation. He came in as my lawyer. Okay. And so I got to meet with him privately during the week. And I had a case manager, prison staff, who I'd gotten to be fairly, had good relations with. And it was really interesting. He said, "Don't you go out there and tell Grisham that we mistreat you, Scruggs." And I said, I said, "I am. I'm going to tell him you prison guards are the most brutal people I've ever been around." And he got in a huff and said, "Now, wait a minute. We ain't guards. We're corrections officers.
Yeah, right.
We're corrections officers, not guards. Don't you tell him." I said, "Okay, I got it." So I went right out there and told Grisham about that story, that what he had just told me, that they don't like to be called guards. They'd like to be called corrections officers. Well, damn if he didn't put it in his next book. And I was still there, and I was just praying that this guy didn't read this. He used that term in that scenario that they don't like to be called guards, but he put it in his very next book.
Julio?
Sure. So I was having dinner the other night with another panelist that I'm not going to name, but one of the topics that we were talking about is his panels were all in politics and how riled up he got because some of the people like were objecting to each other and stuff. And so I sat there and I thought about my panels. I'm like, gosh, I didn't have any disagreements. And so I thought to myself, like, no panel is complete without a disagreement. So I want to go ahead and go on the record and disagree respectfully with something that Dick here said today.
Go for it.
Because this is fun. Dick said that people have been locked up for a long time, don't fear coming back. And I think that that's true for some people, but I just want to make sure that as we walk away, we realize that there's two groups of people who've been locked up for a long time.
Yes.
There's those who wait to get out, and then there's those who work to get out.
Ah, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. I really like ending on a positive note, too. This has been a great panel. Anybody that wants to be interested in prisoners and incarceration and the shameful state we are in right now, I'm just so pleased all of you are here. I'm pretty sure my college class, that CU outreach program, actually pays for the inside students' tuition and books, is the only free college class in the state of Colorado. If there's another one, I haven't heard of it. Bill Clinton got rid of the Pell Grants for free college when he was president. But I also, again, want to just, if any of you are interested in working, volunteering with Focus Reentry or donate money, we need that too, please let me know. We are doing some really great stuff. And I just, one of the great things about both Focus and teaching the Inside Out class is seeing people who have been so demoralized and caged start. The main thing in all of my research and all of this is when they get out that they want to give back to the community. And it's mostly to youth, that I want to keep youth from doing what happened to me.
Yeah, that's good.
And one of the men in my class right now said, I committed domestic violence and I want to get out and work with men to have them not do that. And so anyway, thank you so much for coming. You're a great audience.